Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this show is Lisa DiPiano, a permaculture designer and teacher, who spends her time working on participatory processes that engage and include others in design, democracy, and direct action. We begin with her background and weave through her story of work in Zuccotti Park with the Occupy movement, including the establishment of a gray water system to handle waste, and into larger systems implementing and experiencing change that involve the people part of the process. We close things down with a discussion of permablitzes, rapid-fire building of permaculture systems in a day that blend a variety of people and levels of experience into a work crew that learns hands-on. Throughout the conversation, Lisa provides numerous examples of technologies, systems, and worldwide movements making a more just and equitable world. Her current projects include Mobile Design Lab and Permaculture for Ecological and Social Transformation, or FEAST. The Permaculture Feast is a weekend permaculture design course being offered in Northampton, Massachusetts, from September to December 2012. If you'd like to meet Lisa and learn more about permaculture, this feast is a fine way to do so. Find out more about her and these projects at mobiledesignlab.org and permaculturefeast.org. If you'd like to see the resources for anything mentioned or to leave a comment on this or any other episode, visit thepermaculturepodcast.com. If you have any questions, email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Or, if you would like to have your question played in a future episode, call the voicemail line, 717-827-6266. I hope you enjoy this time with Lisa DiPiano as much as I did. Now, on to the interview. If you're ready to begin, let's start this interview with a little bit about your background and how you got introduced to the world of permaculture.
Sure. So, I always say that I'm in recovery from the suburbs. I grew up outside of Philadelphia, and I was a child of a recent immigrant from Italy, and so growing up, I definitely had my feet in two different worlds. One kind of rooted in a traditional culture. We grew up making tomato sauce and hanging out our clothes to dry, and we always had a garden, and my father was coming from a small village in Italy where they grafted fig trees and stored chestnuts through the winter and just really lived a permaculture life just because that was how their culture lived. And then, so it was interesting in just really just one generation how a lot of that traditional knowledge was lost. And so I've been spending a lot of my adult life relearning some of those skills. And I went to college in West Virginia. I went to West Virginia University, and it was there that I got really involved in the fight against mountaintop removal and got to go down to the southern coal fields and really witness firsthand the destruction, devastation, both on a social and definitely ecological level of the effects of mountaintop removal. So got to really see what we're not supposed to see and how a lot of our homes are heated and energy is created. And that really had an impact on me. And so after I graduated, I got a job. I was working 9 to 5 and just really was struggling with kind of like, wow, this is it. You know, I had a decent job at a nonprofit, but I really just felt like I could do more in shifting some of the systems that I saw as problems coming out of mountaintop removal and also being really active in the global justice movement at the time. And so I saved a bunch of money and got to go to Guatemala, and I worked in a permaculture food forest down there. And that had another pivotal moment in my life where I got to work in a village where there's really a lot of poverty, but got to see some of the innovation that was happening there. And it was the first time that I laid eyes on a gray water system. And what the people I was working with had done was they dug a series of channels and then planted a ring of banana trees. And so all of the soapy gray water was coming down from the village and being treated by these bananas. And then they were getting bananas as a byproduct and also using the leaves and getting clean water also as a byproduct. And I was like, wow, they've really got something going on. And I was really drawn to the solutions-based approach that permaculture takes and was really well aware of a lot of the problems that our culture is currently facing and had been really involved in protests and movements kind of against this global capitalism and extractive economy. But really it was in Guatemala that I got to see some of the solutions, and that had a profound effect.
Guatemala allowed you to see some of the regenerative actions that people could take?
Yes, and it was really in that place that I really was introduced to permaculture and got to witness really firsthand just the abundance of some of the systems, the amount of food that they were able to produce in just a small few acre lot was really incredible. And it wasn't just about the food production, but they also had a women's education and empowerment program. They also were saving some of their indigenous seeds so that they would be protected from multinational corporations. And so there was so many stacked functions going on in that small food forest that it really made an impact.
I've spoken with some people who have done permaculture internationally, and one of the conversations we have is about whether they were working through translation or they were speaking the language. Were you working through translation, or were you able to speak directly with the people you were working with?
I did speak some Spanish. The village was speaking mostly Cachaco, which is one of the Mayan languages. And it's always amazing. I also grew up next door to two Italian grandparents that didn't speak any English. I'm really constantly amazed at how much communication can come across through food growing and working together. And so although there was a language barrier, a lot was communicated. And I think that that's one of the values of really having a permaculture demonstration site, is that you didn't really need somebody to sit down and explain everything to you. Just walking in there and seeing the abundance that was created was a big thing.
And you were able to observe that space, interact with it, and learn from it at the same time.
That's true. There was definitely some people that did speak English. There was at least one person that could speak.
Taking some of that pressure off and making it easier while you're there. I can imagine that would be a really big step, though, to make that kind of a trip and get involved in a foreign culture without the luxury of the language.
Yeah, I think language is kind of built up a lot, and that so much communication happens by working alongside of people and getting to know them in other ways. So I had traveled before internationally, so it was something that I was familiar with. I studied abroad in college.
From our conversation ahead of the interview, you had said that one of the things that you do a lot of work on is participatory design. And I imagine that being someone who likes to have that kind of interaction makes the nonverbal communication something that's more important as you're interacting with people.
Yes, you could definitely say that. Yeah, participatory design has been one of my favorite things to do with permaculture design, and it's been being developed by myself and other colleagues, Keith Morris, Andrew Faust, Mark Krawczyk. And what we've been able to do is really break down the barrier between people who consider themselves professional designers and really giving people some of the tools and a process to really awakening their own designer that's inside of them, and having them be able to see things not only as how they are, but how they could be. And that's one of the most powerful things I see about permaculture design and design in general, is that it allows us to imagine something that's different and gives us steps and working with other people a chance to really build that other vision of what's possible.
What does your participatory design process look like as you're bringing people together to bring about that awakening?
Well, it depends really on the project. A lot of times we'll be doing things like a site analysis, where really if you're just one designer going out and exploring a site, it can take a lot of time as one person. But when you have a group of people out there and breaking up the site into small groups and looking at different layers, you can get to know the site really rapidly. And the great thing about that is every single person will notice something different. And so you can have five people looking at water on a landscape, and each person is going to notice something a little bit different. And so really practicing that principle of diversity in the design process and getting a lot of people involved and looking at it with their own eyes, and then really quickly in a design charrette format, getting together a lot of knowledge about a site. That's one of the ways. We've also, again, in Zuccotti Park, when we were creating the graywater system, that was also a bit of participatory design. We had all the pieces that we were able to kind of smuggle into the park. And then together, working with the kitchen crew, they were the ones that were in the kitchen all the time. They knew the people flows. They knew the dish flows. And we really worked with them to, in the moment, create a gray water system that would work for the people that were actually there and using it on a daily basis.
What was that process of putting in the gray water system in the park like? You mentioned having to smuggle in parts. How were you handling all of that material?
It was really difficult and exciting at the same time. You can imagine Zuccotti Park in October was just filled with media, filled with hundreds of people. There was police everywhere. So it was really kind of a really intense and hectic scene. And so what we were able to do is we worked with another ecological designer that had created a system that was in the Gowanus Canal. And so we were able to work with him to get a couple of his components that were already filled with a really light lava rock because he was using it in the Gowanus Canal. And so that material was extremely light and made it really easy to transport. And so we worked with him, who had a couple of the planted containers, and then worked with looking at waste material that we found throughout the city to get together wood chips for a biofilter, and then just coordinated with people that were already in the park to meet up in an exact minute to help us unload, because we had about 15 seconds. We actually pulled up the truck in between like ABC and CBS and had about 10 seconds to unload all of the different materials. And so just really, it was almost like a performance or a theatrical event, just getting a bunch of people to meet us there at that exact second, help us unload, then get the truck out and carry the system in, all kind of underneath the radar of the police that were around there. And then pretty quickly work with people in the kitchen to modify the system. We were also brought in some hand saws and hand tools that we could actually retrofit the system right there on the site to create something that would work in the moment.
That's amazing. The amount of coordination to get everything moving like that and get it in.
Yeah, it was definitely like it was like a wild goose chase to kind of get all the different materials together and the people together and get that installed.
Because of the engagement of the people who were involved, were you able to like tap into that to make this happen?
Oh, definitely. That the level of mutual aid in the park was totally stunning, and I still get chills really thinking about it. Anything, there's so many people walking through the park that just said, you know, what do you need? Can we get you anything? There was people constantly bringing in food donations, sleeping bags, extra clothes. It was really a moment of illustrating true abundance of what can happen when a bunch of people get together fighting for a common cause. We had a lot of systems up and running. The next thing that we were working on is with a compost collection. And so that when we first got to the park, it had sprung up so quickly that there wasn't really a solid recycling and compost system that was going on. Pretty quickly, we created a sustainability working group, and that was one of the tasks, was to deal with some of the waste that were going out of the park and really transform the whole park into what it really was, which was a demonstration site. It was like a small village of what is possible, what another democratic society that was based on principles of equality and ecology could look like. You know, there was the free library there. There was people giving free haircuts. There was people that were getting free food. We had a microbrewed kombucha one day where somebody rolled up a keg of kombucha and was serving that as part of the dinner line. And so it really was an illustration of what could be possible. And so when we got to the park and set up the gray water system, really the next task was to coordinate with a lot of people that were in the bike messenger. There were bike messengers and really coordinating with community gardens and getting all of the food scraps out of the park and into community gardens where it could be turned into compost and then used on the vegetable plots right there. Not to mention all of the coordination. I was also a part of a group that was coordinating from farms upstate and also from Vermont and Massachusetts. We were actually driving fresh food down every week. There was a load of food, and there was a soup kitchen that donated the use of this kitchen in the night to create meals for the people in the park. So really, in just a short amount of time, there was free food, 3 meals a day. There was a library. There was a gray water system. Eventually, there was bike-powered generators. And so these generators, the first of the generators were taken because the firefighters said that they were actually a fire hazard, even though it was biodiesel. And so then really quickly, the group mobilized to get a design for a bike power generator. And so this is a stationary bike that was attached to a battery and was actually generating energy that could power the media station and some of the other energy needs in the park. And it was actually another way that people could actually interact and participate with the action. They could come to the park and sit on the bike and pedal for a few hours and then give enough power for the media center to keep going.
I'm a bit of a geek when it comes to tech and numbers and things. Do you happen to know what the power output of the bike power generator was?
I could find that out if you wanted the details on that. I don't know offhand.
Okay.
I know that the design came from MIT, and they were able to build it in a way that it was really easy for other people to set them up. There's actually a model, I think, that's on SketchUp of some of the bike designs, and people from the Time's Up bike co-op were really instrumental in getting that going.
I'll see if I can find that, and if I do, I'll include it in the show notes for the listeners.
Okay, and I can also look for that.
Okay, I'd appreciate that. That's something geeky and fun.
Oh yeah, it was really amazing to have people interact with the park in that way and really directly contribute to the efforts to keep the media going, because a lot of the social media is what really made that action spread. And I actually have a slide that shows just how many countries were participating around the world in Occupy Actions, and it's just the amount of how quickly that message spread and the solidarity that it had all over the world is just a showing of how many people are really on the same page. And really, for me, in thinking about permaculture design, thinking about that third ethic of fair share and really how the Occupy protests were speaking to that. And really what we were doing in the park was illustrating, what was possible. Something else that came out of the park is people were forming collectively run businesses. And so there was a collectively run copy shop that came out of that protest, because people were needing to get so many copies of, newspapers and flyers. And so a business was created that's actually democratically run printing business that's still going strong today.
You've mentioned the democratically run alternatives that you found in this. Was that all direct democracy?
Part of what was so amazing about Zuccotti Park was those general assemblies where they were using direct democracy for decision making. Twice a day when I was there in October, there was what was called a general assembly. And so there was a facilitator and a stacker and a note taker. And that's where people could come to find out what was going on and to really direct kind of the tone of some of the actions that were taken as part of the Occupy movement. And so in and of itself, that was just an amazing thing to be a part of, especially the human microphone. And there was just something about seeing all the people. When I was there, Naomi Klein was down at the park. Michael Moore was at the park. We just had really numerous amazing intellectuals and artists that were part of that public space. And when people would speak, they would use the human microphone because we weren't allowed to use anything that would amplify the voice that was electronic. And so people creatively came up with this idea of repetition. And so you had to really think about how much you could say. You would really only be able to say, maybe a sentence at a time, and then it would be repeated back to you. And depending on the swelling of the crowd, sometimes there would be 500,000 people there at the park. It was almost like a wave pattern, in that it would be repeated sometimes up to 3 times. And so the speaker would have to wait, it would repeat it once, and then the people behind them would repeat it, and the people behind them would repeat it. And there's something really powerful in not just listening to a speaker. That's great, going to see a speaker and being inspired that way. But when you're actually participating in it and you're actually speaking the words that speaker is saying to you, it's just a very empowering way of being a part of that movement. And I think a part of why it was so effective.
When I think of education, there's that idea that if you read something, you remember 10% of it. If you like write about it, you remember 20 and so on. There's these different ideas about how you get yourself involved to really know and remember information, and how being involved in that process to not only hear the words of the speaker, but then to repeat it back, how it becomes a larger part of your memory and your consciousness moving forward.
Definitely. Yeah, the words are just reverberating inside of you. And there's something powerful about looking out and you're speaking the same words as the like 500 or 1,000 people around you. Really powerful words. You know, it's kind of like maybe a phenomenon at a football game or baseball game, you know, when everybody's cheering. Yeah, there's just a profound, it really moves you in a different way to participate in that.
And you saw the work in Zuccotti Park and all of these different methods coming together and the direct democracy as a good example of how we can care for one another and offer fair share.
I do, you know, and not, it was messy, you know, it's not this like neat and tidy way. You know, a lot of times the majority rules, somebody just makes the decision and that's it. A lot of times, you know, when people aren't involved in that decision, there can be resentment that builds up, and then you can have the minority coming back. And what I've been a part of, Kettle People, which is a worker-owned collective, and that's how we ran our business. There's no hierarchy. There's no boss. We all made decisions together in a monthly meeting and by consensus. And consensus is definitely something that has to be learned and it's good to practice. And I saw Zuccotti Park really as a way of just practicing direct democracy and really being involved in decisions that affect your daily life. And a lot of times, you know, with representative democracy, people don't even know who the representatives are. They don't have any kind of direct connection, or they have no way of really recalling them if they do something that's not in the lines of what their communities were wanting. You know, you just show up, cast your vote on election day, and that's, you know, if you even do that, and that's it. So I really see direct democracy and looking at horizontal actions and really developing affinity groups that are small groups of people that are working together. It could be on an action, it could be in a business, but really that develop relationships with one another and trust with one another. That's when consensus works really well, when there is that those relationships that have been built up over time. So I saw what was happening in the park is just a practice run of that. And, you know, it's for many years, you know, we haven't had direction over our own lives. A lot of us grow up in schools where you listen to the teachers and then we get jobs and we listen to the bosses. And so there is really a process of really discovering your voice and how much space you take up and all of those kind of unlearning kind of what has happened to us just growing up in a real hierarchical system. So it's a learning process for sure, but it's really the direction that I feel we need to go into people participating and shaping the world around them.
One of the questions that I run across often, and I think that Rob Hopkins has offered a bit of a solution to this with the Transition Towns movement, is how do we take these ideas of regenerative design and participation and really the three ethics of permaculture, earth care, people care, fair share, and implement them? Do you see this process of re-engaging ourselves and working horizontally on a local level as a way that we can move forward and share this information and really begin to make a difference?
Oh, definitely. You can look at another project that's happening. It's actually, this was started in Brazil, looking at participatory budgeting, and now it's spread out of Brazil and it's actually happening in the U.S. There's two examples, one in Chicago and a recent one in New York City. And this is where some of the city councilors have said, I'm going to actually allocate some of this discretionary funding out to people in my district or my ward. And they're actually going to participate in a year-long process in which they identify problems in their communities and that they come up with different proposals on solutions. And people actually come out to assemblies and they get to directly vote for which proposals they want to see in their communities. And so we could start seeing different projects like edible schoolyards or getting rid of prisons and all these different kinds of projects where people themselves get to identify the problems and come up with solutions. So I see Occupy as a disturbance in the system, almost like a forest fire. And it's a real opportunity to say, well, what do we want in its place? We know that this democratic and economic system is not working for the majority of people on this planet, but what do we really want to see in its place? And so by examples like participatory budgeting, that's a longer-term solution where every year now in New York City, people in these districts will get to come together and directly fund and vote and get to see projects, really solutions happen in their neighborhood. And so that's one really concrete example of how this is happening. And also the worker cooperative movement, that has really transformed. There's now a U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops in the last decade that's been established, and we're seeing more and more people really having right livelihood and getting to be their own bosses and cooperatively work together. And that just really stabilizes our communities and economies, because the people that own their own businesses, that, you know, have houses and contribute in their communities, tend to stay there. And so by developing worker ownership, not only do we get to practice workplace democracy and really being able to speak your mind and your values without fear of getting fired, but we're also building longer term solutions for our economy and building jobs that really stay in the community.
In those kind of cooperative agreements, you can, as a group, come together and say, we've taken a financial hit. We can all choose to make a decision where we all keep our jobs, but maybe make a little bit less, rather than saying, okay, who are the two people in this group who are no longer going to have a job at the end of the day? And then they can keep their jobs, keep their houses, and maintain the stability of their local economy.
Exactly. Yeah, and we can really look at examples like in the Basque region of Spain with Mondragon, and really coming out of the Spanish Civil War, just their economy and communities were in shreds. And slowly but surely, they were able to rebuild their economy. And they're now Mondragon is a collection of worker-owned businesses. I think the last time I checked, it was like 250 different worker-owned businesses where each worker got one vote. And so in that example, it's really looking at diversity, where you have businesses that are in different sectors. So you have schools and manufacturing and all these different sectors. So if one sector takes a hit, you know, you're not going to just fold up and fire everybody. You can kind of shift people around within the cooperative and really practicing that principle of diversity. And so that's really worked in the Basque region of Spain. And there's a lot of actually unions that are taking a look at worker-owned factories. And there's exciting examples in Cleveland of hospitals that have actually, each part of the hospital is worker-owned, all the way from the laundry facility to nurses. That's one real solution where people actually have say of where their money is going. You know, if they do make a profit, how can they actually reinvest it in either starting up other worker-owned businesses or reinvest it in projects in their own community?
That's a lot of amazing work going on that I was not aware of in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for your expertise on that. I have some more reading to do.
Yeah, I can give you some links.
Yeah, that would be great, because I can include those in the notes for anybody else who's interested in this.
And really, I think that there's a lot of coalitions that can be developed by permaculturalists. Really, you know, I think that one of the ultimate goals of permaculture is it kind of just goes away, that, you know, these values of earth care, people care, and fair share are just the way that people operate, and these principles are just the way that the world operates. So I think that there's a lot that we can do as permaculture designers to build strong coalitions with other movements that share similar values. And I definitely see there's the local food movement, food justice, workplace democracy, and solidarity economy are just a few that come to me. And I know that, you know, each person has movements that they're a part of that we can really start introducing some of the benefits of permaculture design and some of the ways that we're able to engage people in envisioning and building an ecological and socially just world, that we've got a lot of these skills and techniques for creating food abundance and natural building and all different areas of permaculture that we can lend and also learn from other people in similar movements and really build a stronger, unified movement that can really build this kind of socially and ecologically just future that we're all imagining.
Our conversation has spent a lot of time looking at the social changes that can be brought about using permaculture and the permaculture principles. I've been having some conversations with people about, like, what is the next step in permaculture, and that some of the early writings of Bill Mollison and David Holmgren included some work on social change and alternative economics and things like that, but the majority was about landscape design and building permanent culture through permanent agricultural systems that could then allow people to continue to eat and sustain themselves. Do you see permaculture as broadening away from that early beginning of just agriculture and land design as it continues to develop within the community outward into broader forms of change?
Oh, I definitely do. I've been involved in the permaculture movement for a little over 12 years now, and just in that amount of time, I've really seen it really skyrocket. And really, I think that that's one of our jobs as permaculture designers, is to explain it not just as a gardening system, but really as a framework and a way of seeing the world. And I think that the more that permaculture attracts, you know, it's not just plant geeks anymore. It's not just natural builders anymore. We're starting to attract planners and architects and school teachers and mayors and city councilors and, you know, people from all different sectors of the world. And that really brings about a strong interest because, you know, like even yourself creating this permaculture podcast and being involved in media production, that's just another great way of getting out this vision and design process and network that's really so transformative. And so, yeah, I definitely see permaculture diversifying and broadening, and that's really exciting.
One of the notes that you had sent me about our conversation tonight was the idea of a permablitz. Is that a way that you see to get people involved to learn about permaculture without necessarily going through the full permaculture design course as a way to make permaculture more accessible?
Definitely. I'm constantly looking at how to make this knowledge more accessible to people. We run a permaculture design course that's on the weekends, so that allows, you know, people that are full-time workers that have families or otherwise cannot take off 2 weeks or 3 weeks to take a course, which is the vast majority of people, to be able to take them, as well as working with the University of Massachusetts to develop an online course that people can take as part of a continuing education. And so I also see this idea of permablitzes is a way of getting people that who otherwise couldn't afford, you know, to hire landscapers to come in and totally transform their yard, as a way of getting really friends and other community members together to share skills. And really, it's that power of a barn raising. It's amazing what we can do with a bunch of people in just a short amount of time. And so we've been doing permablitzes here in the Northeast, and it's amazing to see these designs really pop and come off the paper and get installed in a way where people are also meeting each other, sharing food, and then helping each other out in installation of other landscapes. Also another way of getting more demonstration sites on the ground that people can learn from, especially now just dealing with, you know, we were just coming out of a really long drought and have had a series of really torrential downpours, and really developing these systems that can catch and store rainwater and promote healthy soil, all the while growing beautiful, abundant food. And so people are really looking for that. And so the more that that's out there and around, the more that we can link together a lot of these demonstration sites, the better.
Can you give me a quick walkthrough of what the permablitz process is like? You mentioned being able to get a design off of paper and implement it. Is this process one where the group comes together the first day and works with the homeowner on a design and then just implements it? Does a designer work with them first? If you could just kind of walk me through how you've been doing those.
Sure. It can be done a lot of different ways. We've really learned a lot from permablitz in Melbourne. They're really leading the way. I think they've done, you know, over 100 of these permablitzes. And so the way that I've done them is just having a designer create a design for yard with the homeowner and client, and then really working to identify which projects can we accomplish in this day. And really the projects that we're doing, like we just did a permablitz where we were installing a pond that was collecting rainwater off of a shed, planting out a small fruit tree orchard with beneficial understory plantings, digging a hubaculture bed with a lot of the brush that came off of the storm in October, and planting blueberries. And so these are projects where at the start we actually create the design, figure out what we can do, and then put the call out for people to attend these permablitzes. And then at the start of the blitz, kind of go over the day. And so there's a lot of preparation materials that has to happen before the actual day of the blitz. And so at the start of each project, we give a short workshop on, you know, planting a tree and felling a small orchard, a sheet mulching, whatever the task is at hand. And so people really get to learn how to do that part of the design. And then we install it together. Then we break for a really delicious lunch and finish up on the last of the projects. Yeah, so that's a typical day. No blitz is identical, but it's always a lot of fun and people learn a lot.
Well, that gives me and the listeners a nice overview of how that process would come together. And give us another tool that we can use to implement all of this.
Right, because it can be overwhelming if it's just you or you and another person to think about transforming your yard. And again, it's, you know, everybody's got also their own knowledge that they're bringing to that day. Yeah, we hosted a plant swap earlier in the season where people could kind of come together, exchange plants and ideas, and a lot of those plants ended up going into future demonstration sites.
I spoke with Andrew Millison at one point, and he said that only about 25% of the designs that he does ever get implemented in any way. From some projects that I've worked on, you get a lot of people together and you begin them, and then as your momentum kind of starts to flag, you get so far into the project and then you show up and it's one or two people working on it, and then a week later or 2 weeks later you show up and it's just you. And being able to get a big team of people together to really implement a lot of this.
Yeah, that's a key. And then developing, having these different sites, and people really start to talk to one another, because as we all know, you know, the design just keeps unfolding and evolving as you learn more. And you can also share knowledge about different pests and, you know, different ways of dealing with them. And really, you become part of this whole permaculture network. And it really just advances our own understanding of these different plants and how they work together and how these systems work.
I'm looking over all of my notes from our conversation. We've covered a lot of ground tonight. I think that we've covered everything that I wanted to touch on. Before I thank you for your time, is there anything you'd like to add to the conversation?
Oh, let's see. You're like talking a little bit about how permaculture is now really entering into the university system. So that's really a part of permaculture reaching kind of the masses, is permaculture is now being offered in, at least in the Northeast, at universities in Vermont, in New Hampshire, Rhode Island. There's all of these different, University of Massachusetts now has a great program. And so we're really seeing permaculture really getting into the university systems and being able to reach a wider audience of people.
Are you finding that the permaculture classes in the universities are being accepted readily by the administration? Like, is there a lot of conflict to get those taught?
I can only really speak from my own experience, and it's really just getting demand from students, that students are really wanting these classes. They're wanting to learn about regenerative design, and so they're really demanding that. And so I think that the universities are just kind of answering that groundswell coming from the grassroots of the students.
As the students learn more about permaculture and want to settle in and learn it in a formal environment, they're asking the university, and then the university is working with permaculture instructors to make that happen?
Yes, and a lot of times, you know, it's personal relationships. It's not even necessarily the administration decides to do this, but there's specific professors or faculty or staff members that really realize how important regenerative design and permaculture is, and so they're really advocating for these classes to be offered.
Using your social capital and individuals at the university to help make it happen.
Exactly.
I have a friend who teaches at a community college in Austin that they're doing a full permaculture design course down there. I think that may even, there are some folks I know that their courses are being offered for credit.
Yes. Yeah, we teach a course this fall that's offered for 3 credits through UMass.
I apologize. I don't know a lot about your educational background other than the bit that you presented in the beginning. Are you working with someone who, like a professor with a PhD or a master's, who's overseeing the course?
I have a master's in regional planning, and so I'm able to teach.
Okay, you're able to use your master's to leverage into the classroom?
Right. It depends. You know, every university is different. Most universities, you at least have to have a master's, if not a PhD.
I looked at teaching some permaculture classes at my local community college, and without a master's degree, there was really not a lot of movement on it unless it was a continuing education course.
Right. And that's, you know, something that we're seeing is it's not just about the PDC. There's all different ways that people can learn about permaculture, you know, whether that's just an intro lecture at a library or a gardening club, whether that's a full PDC, whether that's advanced PDC courses that are talking about forest gardening or economics or natural building. And so there's all different ways, whether that's working with youth programs and teaching permaculture. There's so many ways that permaculture is able to be taught.
And just as each person finds their own way and their own ability, getting that out there, whether they're calling it permaculture or not, just to share the information so people have it, know it, and can use it.
Exactly.
Well, I look over this, and we've covered a lot of territory. I thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me for another interview. If you have comments or questions about this or any other episode, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and leave a message or send me an email. That address is show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Until the next time, take care of yourself, the earth, and each other.